It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Later in the hour, Iowa's Secretary of State Paul Pate is scheduled to join us to talk about his new voter identification proposal, one he says that is aimed at ensuring the integrity of Iowa elections. He'll be on live in the second half of our program. You can join that conversation with your questions for Secretary of State Paul Pate, 1-866-780-9100. Not yet. It's in the second half hour. But you can also email us now, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org, or tweet us at IPR Talk. Well, of course, we're watching developments in the president's, in the case of the controversy over the president's executive orders on immigration. Federal judge temporarily blocking that executive order that stopped all refugees as well as visitors from seven Muslim-majority countries. And my guest this first half hour is from one of those seven countries named in the travel ban. Chuol Kwat is now a U.S. citizen living here in Iowa in Des Moines. He's been living in the U.S. for over a decade after fleeing war-torn Sudan, his homeland, and spending 6 years in an Ethiopian refugee camp. He's in our Des Moines studio. Chuol Kwat, welcome to our program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here today.
Let's start with the turmoil and the reason you left your homeland in Sudan. A lot of us are aware of the horrific details of that conflict, a very long civil war. Tell us a little bit about what you experienced, and this would have been in your teens, right?
True, yes. There's a lot of Sudanese or South Sudanese community here in Des Moines. Sudan been going on through a civil war with the South Sudan. But right now, Sudan has been divided into two nations. Sudan is no longer one country. So I was originally born from Khartoum, but most people who are, my family would be considered from the South Sudan originally, and so am I. But the war been going on for quite some time, and it's forcing the civilians to move out of the country. Right now, things have actually come down a bit. The South has gained their independence, and the South itself is going through difficulties as well. But it was a long war, and thank God that it is actually over.
Right, so, right. And just some details, because we do, of course, hear some reports. Roughly 2 million people dying as a result in your homeland of war, famine, disease caused by the conflict. One of the highest death tolls since World War II. Human rights violations, slavery, mass killings. And this is where you grew up. So when did you feel you needed to leave? And I understand this is with your parents as well.
It's true. Originally, my parents are from the South, but when I was born in Khartoum, which is in the northern Sudan, I never been to the South Sudan. But my parents actually have everything that they needed. I mean, life was good. But then he was a business person, and he traveled to different places. And at the time when he was captured by one of the rebel group, actually, and then he complained about it, they decided to go after him, stated that how would you, if you take something from an individual, you have to eliminate the evidence. Mm-hmm. Why would you let such individual go? Because they may come after you. And in that case, things have got, you know, chaotic. And at that point, my father saw that, you know what, it probably would be best to not stay here. So when we left, we actually left everything, our houses, our the business, from Sudan to Ethiopia, which is another country as well.
Chuol, when you left, were there signs of fighting? Was there fighting where you were living in Sudan?
There was fighting, yes. And again, people are, if they know you are a person of interest, they can easily, you know, kidnap you or come at night, and there are unseen things that are taking place there, yes.
Right. So plenty of reason for you and your family, your mother and father, to fear for your lives, given the circumstances you just described. So you fled to a refugee camp. You fled to Ethiopia. Tell us about that.
From Sudan, I was 11 by then, 2001, to Ethiopia. And in Ethiopia, they have a few refugees camp because most of those refugees flee from a different country. When we came to the city, well, we, again, my father did, you know, he was a business individual and he did have the money to at least take us around. And then when we reach Addis Ababa, that's when, you know, we have no longer have any resource to go further. But there is there's a refugee commissioner places, the UN actually do transport refugees from there to the camp. And one of the camp was a Shirkola refugee camp. And that's when we went there. And life was...
How many people in Charcoal, you say, is the name of it? How many people in this refugee camp?
There is, I don't know exact number.
Hundreds, thousands?
We're talking about at least 1,000 individuals, all mm-hmm. of them from different, from Sudan, but total speak different languages, but yeah.
What was life like in that refugee camp?
In refugee camp, I myself prefer to go back to where I came from, but... refugee camp.
You wanted to go back to Sudan because the refugee camp was much worse.
Refugee camp was much worse because those who actually live there, there is no work for them. There are no job, but they're being taken care of by United Nations. I mean, they deliver food for them, but from time to time, those food are being delayed.
Yeah.
You know, and I consider myself entrepreneur here, where I. You know, even when I was a kid, I did a lot of things. In a refugee camp, even when I was young, I actually tried to create a different kind of life where I have my own garden where I grow like peppers, and then I take that, sell it to the to the refugees, and refugees will not give me money because they don't have money. They'll give me like corn grain, and then I take that and sell it to the native, which is Ethiopian people. So. it sound funny, but yeah, I continue to do that even when I am here in the United States. I have businesses that I'm going to pursuing since, after the graduation about 4 years ago from William Penn University.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about, before we get to your life here, we do want to hear about your entrepreneurial skills here once in Iowa, but talk a little bit, since this is the subject of our sort of national controversy, about the vetting process. When did you find out that you could come to the U.S. with refugee status, and talk about that process?
Well, the vetting process, most of the refugees' applications are submitted to the United Nations High Commission for Refugees. And then those applications are forwarded to the U.S. Department, U.S. State Department to be prepared. And then decision is made by Homeland Security and Immigration Services. It took about 6 years for our settlement to be approved. But at the same time, there are those who've been there for a decade, and they still haven't left the country.
Okay, so what 6 years in your case? So list some of the things that you were checked for.
Well, normally they check for background. They check. They do a thorough check, like basically your lifetime, like what you have done. If there are certain things that come up in. When those checks are taking place, it's likely that it could ruin your case.
But, so you're subject to interviews, multiple interviews.
There are multiple interviews, correct. And also they're being checked. They have to go through immunization. They have to go. We're talking about interviews, poll check on your health, certain diseases, and, you know, if you have some disease, this may, you know, ruin your application too. It can, they will not allow you to come here.
Did you notice any checks, any questions or checking specifically that you could tell was specifically aimed to find out if you're an extremist of some sort or another?
Well, normally I was a kid, yes, and they normally just, they will ask the adult to... with those interviews, and then they'll bring us in as well. But normally they ask if you know anything, someone that has done such and such. I'm being vague here, so forgive me. But specifically, I don't recall those questions. But there is a massive interview that we have to go through and a long waiting before they can determine the...
Mm-hmm. Having been through the current vetting process yourself, one that is now our president wants to make more extreme than it is, what is your view of the claims that we aren't checking people well enough to come into our country from your perspective? And we've talked on this program with people from the U.S. State Department about the vetting process currently. Is it possible that, do you think that we're letting dangerous people in, having gone through the process yourself?
No, not really. The current vetting process is actually, it's working, meaning that if there are those individuals that come up on FBI file that they have done such and such, it's likely that the U.S. will not allow them to come here. The vetting process we already have, actually, it is huge and it's very difficult. It's not easy as people normally think it is.
I'll just take it while you catch your breath, maybe get a drink there. Chul Kwat is my guest. He's an Iowan who resettled here. He lives in Des Moines. He's a U.S. citizen. His native, the Sudan, of course, a war-torn country until recently, and he's sharing his experience of coming here to the U.S., being vetted as a refugee, and we'll talk in a little bit about what he's experienced since then. So, Chul Kwat, let's move to your first stop in the United States. I understand it was not Iowa, it was New Jersey. Can you recall your thoughts when you first set foot on American soil?
Well, we came on February 17, 2006. I still recall that date.
That's a holiday for you.
It is a holiday for me, yes. One of the holidays. We were settled in a small town called Morristown, New Jersey, which is in South Jersey, about 45 miles away from Trenton and about an hour away from New York City. Everyone was welcoming, actually, and we came through Lutheran Social Services of New Jersey. The family settled there, and yes, we have everything we needed. They made sure that, you know what, we are going to take care of those refugees that come here. But one of the difficult things, the language was a problem. Right now I'm able to talk to you, but at the time it would be very difficult.
Yeah, you sound wonderfully fluent now. I'm amazed that you say you had language difficulties. What was that? You evidently learned English quite quickly.
True. I tried to go to school there when we actually came, but I was 17, and when my parents tried to go to one of their high school over there, they stated that, wait a minute, in the state you have to be 18 to graduate from high school. And at the time, they stated that, hey, we really don't have the resources to train this guy. It's going to take forever before he's going to be too old. Right. When he graduated. New Jersey is a good state, but Iowa it's a home for me now, and
okay.
It's actually a great place to be.
When did you first come to Iowa?
That was in July 31st, 2007. That's when my family moved here. And the reason why, I have an aunt that had been here for about 13 years, been in this state for quite some time, and she called my parent, and because I was having trouble going to school in that state,
right?
She said, okay. She said, if a school is, you know, what you're seeking, if a school is what you're seeking, my dear, Iowa is a great place to come. I'm actually quoting her, and she said, because they're actually aware of refugees being here, and they are aware of their need. I'm not stating that New Jersey is not, but here they have, there's a number of South Sudanese community in state of Iowa, and there's numbers of African, actually, that are resident here in the state. So, yes, most my dream normally when I came here was to come to the U.S., to at least study. That's pretty much what everyone is dream.
Mm-hmm. So but when you got to Des Moines, there was a lot of support. There are other Sudanese in the community, so you felt in a way like you were among your own people to a certain degree.
Correct. Yes, correct. But again, what I was seeking personally is the opportunities such as school education.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit more about that. You said even in a refugee camp in Ethiopia, your entrepreneurial instinct was coming out, even though people had no money to buy what you wanted to sell. So what have you done here in Iowa?
Well, I have the CK vending machine, actually service machines across Des Moines area and other places in the state of Iowa.
So what is your role there?
Normally, I'm actually the owner. I own the company.
You're a company owner. I saw correct. A statistic just yesterday that of the immigrants coming to the United States, there's a higher degree of business starters among the immigrants than of our population here that is non-immigrant. It's interesting.
It is interesting. But yes, before then I tried multiple businesses, but I wasn't. It was difficult for me because the larger company really make it harder for those trying to start up. When I graduated from William Penn, is it all right if I jump there?
Yes.
I was working for a farm bureau, actually, as an agent, tried to start up, build up my own business. And as a college graduate, it was very difficult to really maintain that business because most of the agents, they have to establish their base, build your base. But some of them, actually, they have different businesses before they enter. Mm-hmm. So I try insurance. I try real estate. I try pretty much you name it. Yeah, end of the day, I decided to say, you know what? What is the least thing I can actually do? The least thing I can do. And that's where, the CK vending came about. Yes, there are a lot of businesses out there similar to it. But
yeah. But you're a man in your mid, late 20s now?
I am actually 28, yes.
Mm-hmm. So what are your dreams for business here in the future?
Well, I really look forward to make it a grow, and I want it to be bigger so that I can actually help others by hiring them and also train them to the point where they can do their own. I mean, all of this I didn't do all this by myself. Someone actually assisted, let's say mentors, trainers.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I had really good mentors out there. That are able to, take the time. One of them is actually Andrew Gross and Steve Huffman and William Penn, Dr. Staley. And I have a very good group that is willing to really help me to move forward. Yeah. So my goal is really to create similar situation to be able to help others as well and to, get their dreams that they hope for.
Joel Quant, we have just a few more minutes with you. Been in Iowa now for 11 years, U.S. citizen, originally from Sudan. Let's circle back to the current controversy in our country and how it's affecting you in particular. We have this federal district judge temporarily blocking the president's executive order stopping all refugees as well as visitors from 7 Muslim-majority countries. Now, I understand you have applied for a visa to go visit your family in Sudan, and that's paid for. And so where is that now? You're still going ahead with that?
Well, my uncle actually lives in Khartoum. Again, we are the original from the South Sudan. But I did apply for a visa and was approved to visit there. But what I'm really afraid of is just the how people would actually view the United States. I mean, yes, we have a president that is willing to go further, but at the same time, I think we really need to slow down and see what will impact the civilians. I mean, as I mentioned on the email, that. Trump actually is riding an Air Force One, which is, average humans is not in the same status. Mm. I will be in the airport, waiting for flight, but he will not.
So in particular, though, so are you have plans to visit your family in Khartoum when?
I got my visa almost about three weeks ago, and I still didn't. Well, when I heard about those countries being banned, actually, I decided not to get the ticket because is applying with a U.S. citizen to another country and a country that is not even allowing their people to come here is just, I myself think it is not a good idea to even to even go there. I mean, because the hatred will actually be there. And also, this is a logical question. Why would you even visit a country that that you are not allowing their people to come here? It just doesn't make any sense.
Yes.
Do you have a fear that if you would go visit, that you might not be allowed back into a country of which you are a citizen, a U.S. citizen?
I don't know. Well, if I'm not allowed here in the U.S., and then Sudan or South Sudan will not even allow me to be there. So which country do you think I may fall in? So it's
what kind of reaction have you had from Iowans, where you live, people you do business with, in this current climate with the travel ban having become such a controversy? Supportive reactions? Anybody who thinks you're a threat, perhaps?
Not really, but yes, everyone is scared of those entering the country, or those who are going there. I mean, as myself, if I was planning to visit, but then I decided to change my mind, knowing that, hey, it is a possibility this may happen to me personally. I may stuck in the airport like such individuals who are stuck there right now. But yes, they judge what he did. I don't know how far that's going to go, but it is a possibility that because the administration is not actually giving up.
Right. We're all watching that. The arguments being heard this afternoon. We heard in the top of the hour news. How are your parents today?
My parents are actually doing okay.
And they're in Sudan.
My uncle is in Sudan, but both my mom and dad actually they're here. My father too. He was actually planning to visit, but. I need to ask him what, and I do update him of what's going on in the United States, and he's well aware. So.
Okay. Very quickly, we have just a few seconds left. What's your dream in 10 or 20 years? What will Chuo Kwat be doing?
Well, I actually want to own multiple businesses, but really my dream since I came to the U.S., I wanted to learn how to drive a car, which I was able to achieve. But my next dream was to become a civil rights attorney or defense attorney, is something that it is a possibility it will happen.
Chuo Kwat, we've run out of time. Good luck pursuing your dreams, and thank you for sharing the experience of one refugee and making a home here in Iowa. We wish you all the best.
Thank you for having me here. Appreciate it.
Coming up in our second half hour, Iowa Secretary of State Paul Pate joins me live, and we'll talk about his plan unveiled last week that would require voters to present identification at the voting booth. You can join us with your comments or your questions about this new voter identification proposal, 1-866-780-9100. Email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org, or tweet us at IPR Talk. Back in just a moment with Iowa Secretary of State Paul Pate. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. And we're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Tomorrow on this program, of course, Wednesday, that means it's Politics Day tomorrow, we'll be joined by Jim McCormick of Iowa State University and Rachel Caulfield of Drake University. Of course, one of the items on our docket, the constitutionality of that executive order discussed today, argued today. We'll hear about that tomorrow, as well as how friends and foes of the United States are reacting to the first week of the Trump presidency, friends and foes of the U.S. abroad, to be clear there. Under a plan unveiled last week by my guest this half hour, Secretary of State Paul Pate, Iowa voters would be required to present identification at the voting booth. Pate says his proposal is aimed at ensuring the integrity of Iowa's elections. Iowa Secretary of State joins us once again on this program. Welcome to you, Secretary of State Pate.
It's a pleasure to be here.
I want to reach out to our listeners. We have Paul Pate with us for the next 20 minutes or so. Join us with your questions, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. Email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Tweet us at IPR Talk is another way to get in touch with your question for the Secretary of State. So, Secretary of State Pate, you introduced a bill last week. Your goal, stated goal, improving the integrity of the voting system in Iowa. Tell us, what does the bill do?
Well, it's modernizing our equipment. The elections equipment itself is a decade old or more. It has not been touched. And when you're looking at today's elections processes, so much of it is mobile and You have 40% of the voters voting absentee. You have a significant number of people registering to vote on Election Day. And these are all good things because we see ourselves as one of the top states in the country when it comes to voter participation. But we need to also balance it out to make sure we're minimizing human error and we also are addressing any fraud potential. And this would allow us to do that. It's tying into an existing program that's in 70-plus counties. They call them e-poll books. They're laptops with voting information in there that would assure us that these persons who are voting are eligible voters. They are in the right precinct. And if they've already requested an absentee ballot or voted at the courthouse, it would flag that as well. We want to extend that to other counties. That's part of the bill. And the voter ID component is basically the ignition key. It's what turns it on. When the person comes in, they offer up their card, and they just slide it through a barcode reader, and it identifies they are who they say they are. It gives them the pertinent data. It speeds up the experience and also assures us that we're reducing the human error so you're not going through pages and pages of documents. For those who don't have a voter ID, which is about 5%, we would be sending them a free ID card. There's no photo on it. It's strictly about the barcode, and it's about a voter identification number. That's really the backbone of it.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned human error and voter fraud. These are the two things that you're targeting here with these changes. Give us instances and how prevalent are human error and voter fraud in the state?
Well, it's hard to measure the fraud portion because right now we don't have any kind of system in place to do that. There is no laws or criteria that requires counties to report that data back to us. What we collect is more informal, but we are well aware of some instances. We've had over a dozen counties who have turned over matters to the county attorney or sheriff for investigation.
Excuse me, if you don't have any data, though, what are you basing this on? Voter fraud has been looked at by many experts in the area nationally, and really the consensus, and correct me if with some data, if you can, voter fraud is such an insignificant problem as to really not be a problem.
Well, again, what we're discussing here is not what my bill is focused on. My bill is focused on modernizing the process.
But you fraud, also said it was to eliminate fraud and human error, and I'm just asking
correct.
You for the data, where the data comes, from.
Let me finish.
Mm-hmm.
We have over a dozen cases that we are pursuing prosecution in, those counties are. We also literally have hundreds and hundreds of people who are registering on Election Day that we get kicked back, that their addresses aren't either legitimate or real. That's another issue. But based on what we have for technology today, we don't have the means to be able to follow up on every single person that's getting an absentee ballot to find out if they really are who they say they are. Compare that to Colorado, who just recently reported 21,000 cases of on their mail ballots that they disallowed because the signatures didn't match appropriately. So they said they're not counting them. They have a mechanism. We have none. So I'm not leading this bill based on just fraud. I'm leading this bill on how to modernize the process, how to help the human error factor, how to speed the election process, and frankly, to make sure we don't have any fraud potential if we can by putting the safeguards in before the ballot goes into the box rather than finding out after the fact.
Mm-hmm. So when we spoke in November, and the setting in November was, there was a lot of rhetoric from our then candidate, current president, about voter fraud, people voting more than once, dead people voting. We spoke with you on Election Day on November 7th about whether that was a concern in Iowa, and I just want to replay 30 seconds of your answer there. You called our program, called the iVoters, a very good program. Let's listen to what you said in November.
I also would point out, I think what Mr. Trump talks about, and perhaps the public perception, is we still unfortunately have a few holdout areas where the party bosses, I'll call it, still dominate the elections process, and we need to get past that. Iowa's been very fortunate. We've had a very clean record here, one of the best in the country, and we're not going to let that change so that, everybody's on equal footing. You know, the Democrats get a poll watcher, so do the Republicans. Both party gets a poll watcher there, but no one gets an edge.
Okay, Paul Pate, that was you on the last time on our program back in November. Let's go to some of our callers. Paul Pate is with us, Iowa Secretary of State, talking about a new proposal for voter identification. 1-866-780-9100. Ben is in Des Moines. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Ben. Hey, thanks for having me. I just wanted to say, and I'll take my response off the air. But I just feel like this is a kind of a solution in search of a problem. I feel like Iowa already has a really solid system of elections, and I feel like, and I appreciate. I read an article with Secretary Pate, trying not to make this overly burdensome for voters, and I appreciate that. I appreciate that he's trying to avoid some of the worst excesses of some of these photo ID laws in other states. I appreciate that. I thank him for that. But I still feel like this is creating an additional step that voters have to take on election day, and it's hard enough to get people to come out to the polls without giving them another thing to remember. So I really feel like these types of laws, however well-intentioned, ultimately discourage people from voting, and it tends to discourage people who are poor, people of color, marginalized communities. Those are the people whose votes are most likely to be silenced or discouraged by laws like this. So thanks so much. I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you, Ben. Ben says not a problem that doesn't need fixing. There isn't a problem, and he's worried about disenfranchising voters. What is your answer to that?
Well, again, I want to remind your listeners, if they go online, we have an overview of what the bill is. The bill itself is so much more than just a voter ID. That's the sizzle everybody wants to talk about, because that's politics. That's what's gone on for over a decade, both political parties going back and forth over this whole idea of on voter ID. Is it good or bad? Is it disenfranchised? I'm telling you to get past that. I'm asking Iowans to look at what it does. Over 70 counties use it right now. So those counties aren't having a problem. No one's been disenfranchised. And I appreciate Ben's comments, but I think there's a little profiling going there, and that doesn't match the statistics. When we look at the individuals out there who are voting, we have a good cross-section across the board. And we look at those who don't have an ID card, it's clearly consistent across the board. Again, from 18 to 95 years old, it's the same number of people who don't have a driver's license. We're not reaching there's not one age group or one demographic who's being penalized because of this. It's a generic.
But wouldn't you admit that those who in this 5% I think you quoted, who are not likely or don't have some sort of ID already, they're likely to be demographically seen voters for the Democratic Party.
Well, I'm not sure I could go with that because I've never seen any hard numbers that affect. What I can tell you, though, is we're giving them the free ID card. They're not having to do anything. It's mailed right to them. And if you really look at it, those individuals who are on, the lower income side, if they're using any federal government program, they're having to have an ID for that already. So they've got some ID they're using to be able to access that program. I'm trying to remove as much of this political dialogue as one can and focus on the technology of elections. We have 2 million-plus registered voters in this state that we have to make sure they're accurate, they are eligible voters, and I want to do it in a way that doesn't disenfranchise. The database is what accomplishes that. On that database, we have all the crucial information that we need to access to make sure only eligible voters are there, and it puts the burden on us as administrators rather than disenfranchising the voter. The voter just comes in and does what the traditional ballot process. The only new twist here is a few counties who have not already had this will start using it.
You referenced a huge growth or a significant number of Iowa voters registering the same day. What would this new plan do to someone who for whatever reason, waits until Election Day, discovers they're not registered and would like to go vote?
Doesn't change anything. It's the present same as it is now. They would register, and they'd be allowed to vote, and we'd get them an ID card so that the next election they'd have it.
Would that be a provisional ballot or one that would count that day?
No. Under the present bill, it counts that day.
Okay. Let's get to some more feedback from our listeners. Timothy emailing, if you just joined us, Secretary of State Paul Pate is with us talking about a new voter identification proposal that he has that will be introduced, has been introduced last week, making its way through the legislature. Timothy emailing, how many people over the past 10 to 12 years have been charged with voter fraud or convicted?
Well, again,
going back to the data here.
Again, everyone wants to focus on this as strictly a fraud effort, this bill, and it is not. primarily that. It is much, much more than that. If you want hard fraud numbers, then you need to give our office the ability to measure that and be able to pursue that information.
So right, you're saying now, there is fraud out there, we just don't know about it. That's what you're saying.
Well, define fraud. And
significant fraud.
Define fraud. Is it physical tampering of elections?
Someone
or is it
voting,
influencing
someone voting multiple times? Someone voting who shouldn't be voting?
I can tell you that we have serious numbers to deal with. I told you a moment ago that we have people who we call them kickback voter registrations where they don't match up and we can't track them down as existing voters. That is significant. And when you look at the felon issue, we've got that one turned around because we worked hard to prepare a good list of those folks who've had their rights restored. That's now been provided to all the auditors, but we still had out of 50-some felons who did try to vote, we were able to capture 45 of those and stop them from voting. Five did vote. Again, this is what we know for a fact. If we had the tools that were some of these tools we're asking for, I can give you a much harder number, and it'd probably be a little higher. But here's the bottom line. What is the magic number that tells you that fraud is a problem? Is it 1, 2, 3, 5, 100, 200? That's the political discussion that they're going to have. I'm choosing to approach this from modernizing the election process, trying to give our administrators the tools they need and also allow the voter to have a good experience while they're voting. I don't think there's anything in this bill that disenfranchises people at all.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I would say that it'll actually be a positive experience, just as we did online voter registration last January. That's been a positive experience. 70,000 Iowans stepped up and used it.
Okay.
What's the results? We actually had less people using electronic day voter registration, or excuse me, same day voter registration, because they did their registration online before they got there.
Okay.
They're using it. They're using the technology.
We have less than 10 minutes left with Iowa Secretary of State Paul Pate. Last Friday on this program, Secretary Pate, we heard from Rita Bettis, Interim Program Director and Legal Director of the American Civil Liberties Union of Iowa. I'd like to have you react to her comment on this proposal. Let's listen to some of what she had to say.
The talking points work a lot better than the actual bill as it's written. So it's not true that people wouldn't be disenfranchised or that people wouldn't be turned away or that this would make voting streamlined in any sense. So make no mistake, Paul Pate's voter ID bill, which is what it is, will make voting more difficult and more confusing for voters. It's also expensive for taxpayers. It would cost millions of dollars. The better it's implicated, the more public education that's provided for, the more voter outreach, the more expensive it's going to be. There are no funds available for that. There is no plan to even ask for funds for that. And of course, there's no justification for this. Iowa has some of the best elections in the country. We have some of the highest rates of voter participation and zero indication of any voter impersonation fraud.
Okay, a comment, react to Rita Bettis of the ACLU of Iowa.
I will be up front. She didn't have a single fact correct, not one. I don't know what she's reading. If she has a law degree, then she should go back and look at her law books because it's not even close.
Okay.
The fact is that...
Okay, what about the fact that what about the fact at the end that this is going to cost the state maybe $1 million?
There's doesn't. That's why I said she didn't get a single fact right.
Explain the funding here, please.
The only funding that's involved here is the voter ID cards for those individuals who do not presently have a driver's license or a state ID. That's a one-time cost only. And the initial startup expense is going to be somewhere closer to the $400,000 range. And after that, it's minimal, $20,000
Where does the $400,000 come from?
It comes from the general fund, just like we pay for the other elections. Example, elections in Iowa right now are over $20 million a year we spend on an election. We're talking about $400,000 to implement these cards so that we don't disenfranchise voters, so we don't treat somebody to second tier, so we don't put them in a position where they have to be inconvenienced by going to someplace to get their card. It's, to me, a natural extension.
Tell us about yesterday's yesterday, the Iowa State Association of County Auditors, this is a group, voted Friday. They made this known yesterday to register against your bill. This is a group of key election officials in Iowa, people who know very well about our voting strengths and weaknesses. What's your reaction to this group of election officials coming out against the bill.
Well, I have to admit I'm disappointed that a very select group, it wasn't the association, it was an executive board, which does not speak for the whole membership. There are 99 county auditors who I've had conversations with, and for the most part, they do like many of the components in the bill.
So you're saying the board does not represent the group's opinion?
I'm saying they don't speak for 99 counties. Mm-hmm. I think if you spoke to the county auditors in more specific terms, what parts of the bill do they have an issue with and what parts do they support, we'd find that we have far more people supporting the majority of the bill than opposing it. And we're going to continue to work with the auditors. I've extended that from day one. We've involved them in the past, and we'll continue to do just that. And this is their chance to continue to give dialogue, and we'll see where we can go.
They said in their news release that they're forming a committee that would suggest changes to the bill. You're willing to incorporate their suggested changes?
I'm most certainly willing to listen to them. I need to see what those recommendations are, because at the present time, there are areas that we're addressing in this bill as a result of what we think are areas that need shored up. They may not share that same enthusiasm when we're talking about post-election audits. Right now, 30-some states do those. It's a process where the state would go in and look at these counties to make sure that they are conducting and doing all the procedures correctly. And there are many of those auditors who don't want us in there doing an audit. Well, you know, I understand that, but you know, to be fair about it, we need to do these audits. Mm-hmm. The state auditor does that for cities, counties, and school districts, and elections are, in my opinion, very important too. So we'd like to be able to do that as well, and I think that's one of the areas they're resisting.
Kelly in Iowa City writing an email to us. She'd like you to address the 2014 investigation. This is before your time in office. This was under Secretary of State Matt Schultz. The 2014 investigation into voter fraud, which cost the state $250,000, found very few violations, mostly ex-felons, she writes, who had not jumped through the hoops to get their rights restored. In light of this and the intense budget debate, how can you justify spending money and resources on a voter ID initiative, asks Kelly. That investigation turned up very little after spending $250,000, right?
Well, I'm not going to be here to fight old battles. I wasn't the secretary then. I took the approach when I came into office of going out and making sure we had accurate list put together who these felons are, who had their rights restored, who is not, and we're using that system.
But if you have an investigation and you invest $250,000 of taxpayer money and you come up with virtually nothing, doesn't that indicate that there is a little problem?
Well, I think your definition of virtually nothing is not the same as mine.
So what is your definition about what do you think is out there?
We had significant numbers, my predecessor did, of names that were turned over to the counties for investigation and prosecution. We've seen many convictions as well, but what it really pointed out was just how bad and how poorly we've worded some of the process and how we're monitoring it. So we've had to step up on those areas as well. Mm-hmm. But again, I'm not going to fall into this political gotcha game where we go back and revisit my predecessor's efforts. Again, the people who don't want us to look at accountability and transparency keep trying to make this about politics. Mm-hmm. I have done my very best to take that out of this bill, to make it as technical as possible, to make it transparent as possible, to expect accountability from the auditors as well as the poll workers and our office and anyone involved. So I can't do much more than that at this juncture.
Okay. So your forecast is how are you going to dispel at least the impression that that this is a partisan move? What will you do?
Well, I'm doing it right now by visiting with you and your listeners. I'm going to keep continuing trying to get the ACLU and others like them to actually use the facts when they're talking about the bill. There have been many who have jumped to conclusions way before the bill was in their hands. It's not their father's Buick. This is a much different approach than has been done in the past. And frankly, I think that frustrates the politicians out there who want to politicize it. We've tried to do a very good job of making this as professional and about hard procedures to make it a better experience for the voter, but also to make sure there isn't going to be fraud and there isn't going to be human error. And if there is, we'll know about it so we can correct it.
Okay, thank you very much. We've run out of time.
Thank you.
We appreciate you coming into our studio, Iowa Secretary of State Paul Pate. We appreciate your time, sir. River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Claire Roth. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Tomorrow, of course, it's Politics Wednesday. Of course, we'll talk about the constitutionality of that executive order by the president restricting immigration from 7 Muslim-majority countries. Jim McCormick of Iowa State University, Rachel Caulfield of Drake University with us. Also, how friends and foes of the U.S. abroad are reacting to the first weeks of the Trump presidency. Join the conversation tomorrow. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us today.